This is a crusade. This is a holy war against the deep state.
Where are the dictators? Where are the strong men?
Donald Trump is our instrument for retribution.
I'm going to fight for Christians. I'm going to fight for white people.
They have the Great Reset. We have the Great Awakening.
And why shouldn't I root for Russia?
Because I am.
I want to see these people go through misery because of their grooming against our children.
After the assailant entered the home asking, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol.
I did nothing wrong.
Welcome to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, where we cut through the noise and help you make sense of the chaotic information space around us. I'm Griff Somke. On this episode of the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, I am joined once again by Mike Centers, who is a PhD student specializing in the intersection between online radicalization and use of language in gamer culture, as well as Andy Vitek, who is an associate teaching professor of political science and director of the counterterrorism option of the World Campus Masters in Homeland Security at Penn State University. Mike, Andy, great to have you guys on today.
Thanks, man. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to be back and glad to be on here with Andy.
So stop me if you've heard this one before, but it seems gamers are upset about the amount of woke content in games these days, and they think they've found a culprit. A company out of Montreal called Sweet Baby that does consulting for a number of game studios is the latest target. Sweet Baby Incorporated was founded by former Ubisoft developers Kim Belair and Ari McGillivray. Specifically, it seems like a lot of the negative attention has focused on Kim Belair, which is absolutely pure coincidence, I'm sure, and nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman of color. So let's talk for a second about Sweet Baby, what they do, and why a company like Ubisoft would hire them to work on a game.
So, I mean, just if we look at sort of the ways in which that just basic video game development proceeds, given the degree to which the production process has, you know, very much kind of mirrors the complexity of film productions. You know, there are going to be a variety of areas where a video game developer, rather than develop certain kinds of capacity in-house, will opt to, you know, subcontract with various elements. And, you know, hiring, say, consultants to work on certain maybe elements of the script, or maybe consult with elements of the writer's room to address maybe, you know, certain elements of the narrative, certain elements of certain characters. You know, that's a process that has been, you know, a part of any kind of large-scale writing production in both video games, in film, in any kind of large-scale creative media production. And so the idea that a company like Ubisoft or Rockstar, any of these major companies would, you know, effectively subcontract with various kinds of consultant groups for specifically work in the writer's room, to work on elements of narrative, character development, etc. That is an absolutely ordinary, expected, and largely mundane part of large-scale production of any form of media.
Kind of the same way that, like, you would subcontract out certain, you know, like voiceovers and things like that. It just doesn't seem all that controversial, but it really seems to have hit a nerve with certain people on YouTube. Certain gamers are finding themselves really offended by this. And they went and dug up some old clips of this woman, Kim Belair, talking. And this is from an article on a site called thatparkplace.com. And they're quoting her saying, "So, despite the changing face of audiences, despite the changing face of conferences like this, we still look at our core demographics and say, okay, they're white, cis, hetero males. And we cater almost exclusively to them. And the problem is that we don't just cater to them like, you know, here's something we think you'll enjoy. We cater to them like a picky baby." She elaborated, "We feed them the same thing that we know that they love, and we keep on feeding it. We're like, here you go. We know you love it. Eat this, eat this, eat this. So then when they get anything else, they react as a picky baby would, which would be like, oh, no, thank you. I do not want this. And we've actually done this so long that what we're doing is creating an entire nation of picky babies, and they make us scared to deviate from what we actually want to do, just in case those picky babies don't want to play our games." So people got really upset about that observation, but is she actually wrong? Well, I'm a filthy casual at best when it comes to gaming, but looking at it from that perspective, it seems like a pretty fair observation.
I mean, I would argue that she's right about that, right? So, I mean, the idea that game development caters to a very specific audience of mostly cishet white men. It's always kind of been the case. That's been the core demographic of the video game, kind of core, since video games have been a thing way, way back when, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would argue that indie game development has been catering more towards a diverse audience range. But if you look at quote-unquote AAA game development, right, you look at what major studios like Ubisoft, Activision Blizzard, Remedy, Warner Brothers, all the really kind of big game studios, what they're producing, it does cater specifically to kind of what white men kind of want to see, and any sort of diversity that is included in the narrative or is kind of added tends to be very surface level, right? It's not actually very deep. It's not actually very engaging. And in fact, a lot of queer people have accused these bigger game studios of just kind of adopting a queer aesthetic, or, you know, bringing on one character that might be bisexual or homosexual, but like, they just kind of exist, right?
Right.
So, I mean, she is right in saying that, like, big game studios do kind of cater to the kind of white male audience, and they have a thing that they want, right? And deviating from that in any sort of ways tends to call down a lot of animosity, to put it mildly.
That's a very mild way to put it, yes. seem to have seen what some people are referring to as Gamergate 2 starting up around this. Now, for those of you who are blissfully unaware of what the first Gamergate was, it was actually all about ethics and video game journalism. No, just kidding, I had to say that. But it was a movement that started off amongst gamers believing that there was an undue influence going on between journalists and studios, and that certain games weren't getting made because of the way studios were catering to what journalists were saying about this. And this somehow turned into this raging hive of misogyny and violence.
Yeah, that's a pretty solid explanation as far as the events go. I know, talking about the kind of long-term consequences or legacies of the movement, at least for folks like myself and Mike, who kind of view it via its context and effects on kind of the trajectory of the development of both kind of the alt-right and the far-right over the past couple of years. Most discussions, understandably, tend to focus on kind of those immediately visible activities, specifically, right, the extraordinarily vicious and misogynistic harassment campaigns that were directed against primarily women, people of color involved either in or tangentially related to video game journalism reporting, media figures such as Anita Sarkeesian, etc. And Mike, you can certainly either kind of correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've always kind of seen the kind of long-term effects of Gamergate fundamentally as twofold. The first is that it was kind of the initial field test for how the kind of trolling and harassment tactics that had been part and parcel of 4chan and Chan culture for the better part of a decade. It was the field test of how those tactics could be utilized and weaponized by a coherent political movement. And that is, I think, an element that has been pretty well documented in terms of how, you know, folks like Steve Bannon, Milo Yiannopoulos, and other kind of more conventional right-wing figures were able to kind of utilize and leverage the activities that came out of Gamergate and very much kind of snowball that not only into the 2016 election, but, you know, develop it into this very consistently and still utilized tool set that is very much part and parcel of the online far right now. The other element of it is that I think it really effectively created a blueprint for essentially bringing in or adapting kind of core elements of far right mobilization and engagement for a population that prior to then had no political engagement. in that when we think about how the basic DNA of far-right mobilization is structured, and that it's inherently conspiratorial, right? In that whether we're talking about kind of old school anti-Semitism around things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or more kind of contemporary Great Replacement theory, it all leverages this idea of a malign conspiracy that is targeting cultural touchstones, targeting the nation, targeting the West, et cetera, et cetera. And Gamergate provided this really, in many ways, novel approach for kind of taking that conspiracism package and tweaking it in a way that enabled the large-scale politicization and, in many ways, radicalization of large swaths of, you know, self-identified gamers who are not politically involved in any way by essentially presenting them with the narrative of a conspiracy targeted at what they viewed as gaming culture, right? In that rather than, you know, a cabal of Jewish elites, it is the social justice warriors who are launching this external attack on these various cultural touchstones that you have a very strong attachment to.
Yeah, I would agree with Andy there 100%. And I can remember thinking when I was kind of looking back at Gamergate as we rolled into this year, with the being the 10th anniversary coming around in August, I remember thinking, oh, wow, when I go and I examine the rhetoric that Gamergaters were using at the time, it's really kind of baby's first great replacement theory, right? Like, that's how I kind of framed it and how I thought about it. And at first, I'm like, that can't be right, right? But then you dig into the rhetoric. And as Andy was saying, it's the creation of this language that kind of bonds all of these young, predominantly young white men together in this conspiratorial mind frame that then primes them to be more open to accepting more broader conspiracies, I believe, right? So it's, if you can win over these apolitical, mostly apolitical young men into saying the SJWs and women are coming for your video games and coming for, you know, your scantily clad digital women, they want to put clothes on them, then you prime them to accept this kind of watered down version of the protocols or of Great Replacement theory. And then once they're in that mindset, once they're comfortable with that language, it then becomes much easier to feed them this more broader conspiracy, right? Of like, well, okay, the SJWs are coming for the games. By the way, did you know that the Jews are coming for the white man? And they're kind of primed to accept it.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the effect that we saw things like QAnon have. We think of the ways in which yoga moms via their discourse around things like human trafficking, especially the way that conspiracy theories regarding big pharma started propagating in QAnon circles during pandemic. And yeah, once you are able to kind of get an individual over the hump that there is this malign conspiracy being directed against key cultural and national arenas, like once you're over that threshold, the rest of it is a lot easier. It's not that difficult to advance someone further along that path once you've already established, again, that basic conspiratorial foundation.
Once you've taken the red pill, so to speak.
Exactly so.
It's all right there.
Yeah, exactly. And to kind of add to this, not only is it easier to kind of, you know, railroad them onto more conspiratorial, broader conspiratorial thinking, but once they inhabit this language of conspiracy, it naturally isolates them, right? Because the kind of languages, the language games, as I call them in my kind of academic parlance, that you use with the wider world or that you use with your friend groups, you know, we switch each of those out depending on the social circumstances that we're in. Like, I'm not going to talk about Shohei Ohtani and how he's the greatest baseball player of all time and how he's just great at everything if I know the other person doesn't know anything about baseball, right? I can start quoting like statistics and RBI at them, and they'll look at me like I'm kind of speaking a foreign language, right? But in that case, me wanting to prattle on about Shohei is just kind of annoying to someone who doesn't get it. But once you start going into conspiratorial talk, if you start talking about how oh, the women are coming for my video games. There's this broad conspiracy to make games woke, right? That's annoying and somewhat concerning. But then once you're further along the road and you're into like Pizzagate QAnon territory, if you're sitting at the dinner table with your family and you say, by the way, did you know that Hillary Clinton eats babies and harvests adrenochrome? That goes from just being annoying to having everyone else at the dinner table start to feel very uncomfortable, right? And then that isolates you from other social groups, so the only place you find acceptance are with the people who are speaking that same language, right? So it's very insidious.
And that very much, I think, kind of highlights why this particular population is of such concern, in that self-identified gamers, and at least within the context of the kind of gaming communities that were radicalized by via the first Gamergate and the kinds of communities and circles that, you know, Mike and I are worried about this time around, like, these are already communities and individuals characterized by a very high degree of social isolation and social atomization already. Like, these are already highly isolated individuals without significant and diverse social ties that may, you know, exhibit some form of push or pull factor that might steer these individuals away from this pipeline.
Right, right. And, you know, we're seeing social atomization get worse everywhere in society. We're definitely seeing the idea that people are not out in the world the way they were a generation ago, two generations ago. People have kind of retreated inwards. And stuff like this, like you're saying, makes it even harder for them to relate to anybody outside of their sphere, anybody outside of their little bubble at this point. And that's bad. These are people who are kind of at risk anyway. And for them to be only able to relate to the people who are pushing this narrative becomes very concerning in terms of where does it go from here.
Absolutely. And I also really appreciate that you use the term risk, right? In that so often, I think, and this is, these are the, some of the types of conversations that can end up being really counterproductive, especially when talking about questions of social isolation and radicalization, whether we're talking about gaming communities or what have you, right? It's so easy for individuals to talk about how this is a cause of radicalization, and that isolation is radicalizing these people. No, obviously that is not the case. It's so easy, especially with a lot of the media discourse around questions like this, to conflate sociological risk factors on the one hand and causal factors on the other, because I'd argue that there is almost no evidence that, you know, being socially isolated, being a self-identified gamer, being, you know, really into like online anime communities, whatever, there's no evidence that that's a cause. But again, this idea that social isolation can create openings, that's just another risk factor. And a risk factor doesn't mean that you're going to end up going down this path. It's just adding that extra layer of vulnerability.
Right. You're open to it at that point. And you're open to it in a way that somebody who doesn't have those same circumstances just isn't. So yeah, if you're in a position where you're open to that and there are bad actors in the space, which was something we saw a whole lot of with Gamergate 1, we saw people like Steve Bannon, like Milo Yiannopoulos, like Mike Cernovic, like Ian Miles Chung, who were using this opening to push some pretty terrible content to their new audience as a result. And some of these people, like you said earlier, went from having absolutely no political beliefs at all to, in one particular case, taking the husband of Nancy Pelosi hostage and trying to assault him and kill him. That's how far this goes sometimes. And it's really terrifying.
I think one thing that you mentioned, that both Andy and Griffey both mentioned in terms of this idea of risk, right, is the idea that, like, it's not the video games and it's not the anime itself, right, that's causing this. It's a matter of risk factors. But I think the important thing to also mention is that some of these communities do end up attracting more bad actors than others, right? Like, as someone who kind of exists within kind of the gaming sphere and within the kind of anime sphere, like, what's happening within each of these kind of fandoms is these used to be just very broad, very general, kind of all-encompassing, like, you were a gamer, you were kind of like a weeb slash otaku, right? Now, because so much discourse has been like injected into these communities, you're seeing these more broader communities start to kind of self-fracture into like, well, I'm a lowercase g gamer, right? Like, I like playing video games. I've put way too many hours into Helldiver 2 over the past couple weeks. But like, I'm not a capital G gamer, right? Because, you know, I don't believe in doxing, you know, women and people of color because they have what are in the end very kind of mild critiques of the gaming industry. And so, and I think that's important to kind of mention because there are some people who will want to try and foist blame onto the actual content itself. And I actually think that's kind of coming out in an interesting way with the evangelical right now and how they're on this crusade against pornography and degeneracy, right? And how I don't think it's coincidental that, like, gamers with a capital G are doing Gamergate 2 right now as the people they're in a political coalition with start to attack some of the content that they hold dear, which is like degenerate smut, which, fair, like, I'm degenerate smut can be fine and fun, all well and good, but like, there's a rapid realization that this is a very tenuous political alliance, right? And I feel like part of what's going on with this Gamergate 2.0 thing is a kind of reaction to this evangelical movement against pornography to say, look, no, we're against degenerates too, right? Who are doing all this woke stuff in video games and very much trying to like deflect away from them and like keep this political alliance kind of in cohesion.
Yeah. And I think, Mike, I entirely agree with all of that. And I think this question of why is it happening now, I think there are a couple of potential explanations that we can point to. And I think, right, I think you're absolutely correct, pointing on the one hand towards this kind of revived evangelical-led narrative directed against primarily, you know, traditional sexual mores, etc. But I think the kind of structural state of the gaming industry in general, I think, is creating opportunities now that have not been present over the last 10 years, because the usual suspects in the Gamergate circles have been trying to reignite this for quite some time. It's not like they've been dormant for the last 10 years and just not attempting to kind of start another round of harassment, mass radicalization, etc. But they haven't been able to get a lot of traction in the last 10 years. I think in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, very large gaming companies were kind of moving in a direction all on their own. It's these trends that we observed first and foremost in the kind of indie gaming sphere in the early 2010s started spreading to AAA studios and the same reason why we see, you know, more diverse representation in Hollywood films. That was just kind of the direction that media was going because the audiences were getting larger, they're getting more diverse, etc. But now, some of you may know that many AAA game studios have been kind of in a major realignment crisis period. This has been marked by significant layoffs across a lot of the biggest AAA game houses and game publishers over the past couple of months. For the same reason any large company within the media sphere will opt to downsize or lose money. This is a very inefficient way of producing media. But that has certainly allowed these actors to generate a narrative of an industry in crisis in ways that the past couple of years have not allowed them to do. And the fact that they have an entity like Sweet Baby allows them to also kind of go back to externalizing the threat, right? It's not that these companies are deciding to make these games this way out of their own creative decision making. It's right. There are these external malign entities that are influencing them, that are coercing them. Because when you look at how a lot of the narratives are being constructed here, they kind of have the consultant subcontractor relationship reversed, right? In that the way a company like Sweet Baby works is a company wants them to come work on their product and we're going to pay you money for your expertise. The way it's framed within the Gamergate circles is that companies like Sweet Baby are able to, through the requirements of things like DEI and various other like diversity boogeymen, are effectively able to foist themselves on these companies, force them to hire us so we can move your product, move your narrative in certain directions. And I think this kind of combination of factors, going back to, again, what Mike mentioned about this kind of re-embracing of more traditional culture war topics mixed with a pretty tumultuous financial period for AAA gaming, and the fact that they now have external actors that they can cast in this boogeyman role, I think it's kind of creating a bit of a perfect storm. And that's certainly kind of the basis of my worries at this point, is that we, for the first time in 10 years, we're actually seeing kind of the stars align for these guys in ways that they just haven't over the past 10 years. Because I do think they haven't stopped trying. Like like Mike, I'm sure you can echo this as well. Like we've seen countless attempts to start that furnace up again. This is the closest they've gotten, arguably, since 2015. I don't know how you may be up on some stuff that I'm not, Mike, but I have not seen it come this close to where we were probably since then.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said there, Andy, specifically kind of how this idea of vulnerability within the game industry with all these layoffs, right? Sony, Microsoft, Activision, Blizzard, just so many, like you can't throw a dartboard at, you know, all the names of the big companies and not hit a company that hasn't downsized here recently. So the idea that like the game industry is somehow imploding, and there must be a reason for that, right? And the reason is all this inclusion of narrative diversity. That's a very good point. In terms of them attempting to kind of like reignite the Gamergate furnace, the only time I think they've come relatively close was when The Last of Us 2 released. There was a lot of hullabaloo about one of the characters in that, and it ended up igniting a bit of a firestorm, but it was clamped down on pretty quickly, and Naughty Dog had already kind of been a pariah for a long time in the eyes of quote-unquote capital G gamers. So it didn't get a whole lot of traction because, like, a lot of people kind of already hated Naughty Dog for one reason or another, so there just wasn't a lot of, like, room to breathe more fire into that. I think this idea of casting Sweet Baby as an external enemy is really, really good, especially when you look at how some of the rhetoric on, like, some of these subreddits has been fostered, right? They're all trying to connect people who either work at Sweet Baby or Sweet Baby itself to, like, the primary villains of Gamergate 1, right? Like, they're trying to rope in Zoe Quinn. They're trying to rope in Anita Sarkeesian, where, like, there aren't real connections there. Or, like, they're just bringing up, like, hey, like, look how bad Anita Sarkeesian's life is now by, like, showing a picture of her being very happy at her birthday party dressed as a bride, right? The fact that, oh, she's unmarried, right? We did that, and we can do that to these people at Sweet Baby. And it's interesting that they've picked this specific kind of narrative consultant company out of all the other ones that potentially exist, right? Because they have consulted on some very big, very prominent games within the past couple of years, right? I'm looking at their kind of list of games they've worked on. They've worked on God of War Ragnarok. They've worked on Insomniac Spider-Man 2. They've worked on Alan Wake 2. And yet, it's interesting, right? Because all of those games can be considered like blockbuster successes, right? All those games won plenty of accolades. All those games made a lot of money. And yet they're somehow trying to say those games were failures in some way, shape, or form because Sweet Baby consulted on them. They made them woke, right? And it's just been very interesting to kind of see that dichotomy at work.
Well, what's also very interesting, and I went and looked this up, is that you mentioned that the last time anything like this got traction in any significant form was probably The Last of Us 2. Well, I went and looked up the release date for The Last of Us 2, and it turns out that was June 19th, 2020.
Oh, dear.
So it seems very interesting that maybe this happens every 4 years for, you know, I don't want to.
Can't imagine why. Oh, I'm sure that's just a coincidence.
Right. So it's a coincidence, I'm sure, but it's an awfully interesting coincidence that this happens in election years.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, I mean, a lot of factors could come together here to generate something like this, but you got to look at the big picture, and the big picture is we are looking at an election here, and they caught lightning in a bottle with this one time, and they were able to leverage this block of people who politically had virtually no opinions before and turn them into diehard supporters of a certain candidate. Well, why not try it again? And then why not try it again after that?
Yeah, that's an interesting that you pointed that out. And but also, like, the fact that they're able to deploy this so much more efficiently now, right? Because we have to remember that, like, Gamergate 1.0, the original, the OG, actually started in 2014, right? Not an election year, but it whipped up such a frenzy in its original iteration and kind of radicalized so many of these young men that when 2015, early 2016 came around, because the Republican primary that year, it was actually like a year and a half long debacle, right?
Oh, absolutely it was.
There was still enough of that residual energy around that the Trump campaign was easily able to step in and weaponize it, but it was like pre-primed for a year in advance. And like, what would have happened if Gamergate happened a year or two earlier? Would enough of that kind of residual energy had been there for Trump to effectively weaponize it? Who knows? But it is interesting now that it's so pre-primed within so many young men that a controversy can occur and they can be deployed, you know, very, very quickly, very efficiently now, you know, within the election year, rather than having to build it up a year beforehand.
Right.
And I think they're also hopefully looking to leverage this into an expansion, and that, you know, as you mentioned, we're a good 10 years down the road. And in those 10 years, most of the kind of traditional Gamergate crowd has more or less been quarantined in a lot of ways. You know, they've definitely seen, you know, a lot of cross-pollination with your standard kind of anti-woke content creators. But I think, as we've seen with certain content creators that have started moving into that space after not being overly political, you know, we think of folks like Asmongold, who has absolutely jumped on kind of the anti-woke bandwagon. I think he's put out easily 4 or 5 videos talking about Sweet Baby in the past like 3 days. You know, these are content creators that have access to very, very large audiences of people who are not politically engaged and not politicized, in many ways kind of mirror the kind of more atomized folks that were swept up in the original Gamergate. And I like, the major fear that I have right now is that a second Gamergate wouldn't just necessarily usher in this new, you know, storm of harassment, doxing, etc., but it has the potential to pipeline an entirely new population into these far right circles, especially among kind of the younger Gen Z crowd, who, again, are not necessarily politically conscious in any significant fashion. You know, they're not necessarily on Reddit and Twitter, right? They're on TikTok, they're watching streamers, etc. And that represents a gargantuan audience.
Right. And a shocking number of them at a young age are actually big fans of people like Sneeko and Andrew Tate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you have something like this that could give them a cause.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to sit here and marinate in all this toxic shit, which they're doing. but then to all of a sudden have a cause and be directed at that cause, because I'm looking at some of these videos, people like Asmongold are clocking 500,000-600,000 views in a few days on a YouTube video on this.
Huge.
And yeah, you find yourself thinking it's a matter of time before that audience and these numbers come together. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that kind of hits at one of the things that makes far right mobilization so effective. And I know if you've had a number of guests in the past talk about this, in that when you look at how far right messaging is packaged and presented, right, it's always in defensive terms, right? We need to protect the culture. We need to protect the nation. We need to protect this, this, and that. That has the ability to motivate in ways that other kinds of programmatic, policy-oriented persuasion just doesn't, because it points to something tangible that people already have. This thing that you have, this thing that you like, is at risk. It is under attack. And if you don't take action to defend it, you will lose it. As opposed to various other political movements that may leverage, you know, action for more aspirational causes, that's not tangible. That's not something you can see or touch. Like, this essentially puts this thing that these populations have a very strong connection to and say, yeah, this is under attack. And if you don't protect it, you will lose it.
Right. So for them, they've got a cause. They've got something that they can look at and say, we don't want this to happen. We don't want to lose this thing that we all really like. And then you give them an action item. And the action item is some low-level harassment at this point. The subreddit of trying to figure out which games are consulted on by Sweet Baby. You know, they are trying to get that boycott going. But we're really at a point where it's not going to take too much of a push to get this going in a different direction.
Absolutely. I agree. And we're teetering up to that point, right, of someone in this crowd is eventually going to take this messaging seriously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the thing with far-right rhetoric, especially with rhetoric that is defensive in nature, which is most of it, there's the implication that someone needs to do something, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's never actually a statement of action, right? No one ever actually says, you know, in terms of like Islamophobia rhetoric, no one actually says go shoot up the mosque, right?
No.
But there's the implication of these people are here, they're stealing our lives, you know, they're stealing our jobs, they're corroding and eroding at our way of life. Someone needs to do something. Always very ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And it only ever takes one person taking that rhetoric very seriously for a tragedy to occur, which is, again, I think Andy maybe shares a similar fear about this with me. But once this goes into like a lot of doxing and a lot of death threats, it's only going to get worse and worse, because as this action builds up and doxing and death threats don't become enough to change things, something else has to be done, right? And so as this kind of develops, I'm going to get more and more worried about that. And to kind of speak to this idea of cross-pollination, and kind of the other thing I think far-right rhetoric does really well in terms of like community building, is it creates a sense of shared purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Not just in the defense, but also in like going out and like owning these people on Twitter or on YouTube, right? I just typed in Sweet Baby on YouTube to see what all was coming up. And it's, of course, a lot of really bad thumbnails with really stupid titles. But one video after scrolling down a bit that I noticed is a video by a content creator called Hiro Hei. He's known within the kind of anime community and the VTuber community for being a kind of far-right-esque pundit. He talks on broader cultural war issues in general occasionally, but he mostly focuses on how, like, anime is great. It's this great thing that libs and SJWs are attacking, and that's kind of his line, right? He's more in the weeb VTuber category of things, but he's posted 3 videos about Sweet Baby within the past couple days.
Mm-hmm.
I think he posted one just this morning. Yeah, 21 hours ago, so not quite this morning, but yesterday. So he's funneling people who maybe weren't originally exposed to the original Gamergate in terms of people who are involved in like the VTuber community, right? Who maybe got onto that bus, that train when it became popular a couple of years ago, and maybe knows of like what happened with Gamergate and knows the broad strokes, right, of what happened. And maybe they think nostalgically back to it about, man, I wish I could have been harassing Anita Sarkeesian, right?
Yeah.
Now here's this chance, right? Now here's a chance to kind of be a part of this much broader community action, right? And being able to create that sense of community through language and rhetoric is immensely powerful. It's just being done for a very, very bad, awful thing here, and that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right, Mike, in that when we look at the radicalization risks associated with something like this, it is very multifaceted in that on the one hand, we can talk about, again, this idea of a mass radicalization and just kind of the growing of the ranks of the far right in a more general sense. As you mentioned, you know, we've got this issue of other far right actors kind of using this as a way to kind of segue and pipeline people into their own specific brand of content. And of course, right, we have this ever present risk of violent radicalization as well.
Yeah.
I know, Griff, you mentioned, of course, the individual who showed up at Nancy Pelosi's house. Yeah, a lot of this rhetoric, especially once we start looking at some of the rhetoric in the kind of more traditional Gamergate circles, like this is stochastic mm-hmm. terrorism. This is rhetoric that implicitly is a call to action. And yeah, 99.9% of the people will stick to just harassing people on Twitter.
Right. But.
But that 0.01% person has the capabilities to do a lot of damage in that, you know, when we look at the, you know, instances of lone actor terrorism, especially far right lone actor terrorism of the past 10 years or so, this is highly lethal. Like compared to most terrorist activities, the far right lone actor, you know, long gun right. style attack, these are very high lethality mm-hmm. events. Like the average terrorist attack, even carried out by a formal organization, is going to kill on average around 20 people. And that's kind of the level we're seeing with the average, you know, far right lone right. actor. Like this is extraordinarily dangerous. And these acts of violence, these acts of terrorism are themselves, you know, mass radicalization events, because, you know, we're in the era where, you know, these guys are wearing GoPros. They are live streaming their actions. Their manifestos, the, you know, plagiarized pieces of garbage that they are going to circulate like wildfire in all of the usual cesspools.
Well, and they all want to top the high score. They all know about each other. They all exactly. want to make sure that they get the yeah. high score. And everybody else who's, you know, pushed to this point can stand back and say, well, we didn't want anybody to do that. The minute one of these kids
yeah.
does that. And, you know, we just had a gentleman named Jacob Ware on the program, who is also a counterterrorism guy. And we talked a lot about how this is a strategy and has been on the part of the right for decades now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea of leaderless resistance, right, is to create a firewall between the leadership of the organization and the militant wing of the movement.
Right.
And that, you know, in the wake of the feds coming after us in the 1980s, the 1970s.
Uh-huh. They knew they were lucky to get out of Fort Smith, and they figured out that they're never yeah. going to put themselves, if they can help it, in that situation again.
Yeah.
But they still want to strike a blow at Zog.
Yeah.
So this is how they do it now.
Yeah. And in many ways, like Fort Smith was a vindication of kind of the earlier iterations of leaderless resistance, mm-hmm. right? They had already started prior to the early 1980s, already started putting that degree of separation in place.
Mm-hmm.
And Fort Smith was the biggest vindication that they could get for that strategy for guys like Beam and, you know, the various white power folks who got caught up in Fort Smith. And it's, I think those lessons, even though, you know, does the average GamerGator know who Louis Beam is? No, obviously not. But I think the legacies of, you know, those tactical and strategic choices are absolutely evident in this movement.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Massively so.
And I definitely think that's something we're going to want to talk quite a lot about going into an election year, going into this, able to say, we see you, we see where this is coming from. We've done the homework here. We know where this is all coming from, and to call out those actors, the way people are calling out libs of TikTok now, hierarchic, whenever somebody gets a bomb threat, whenever somebody gets a death threat as a result of, you know, her Twitter feed, being able to say, no, this is happening because of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can sit here and act like it isn't, but you have to know at this point.
Absolutely.
This is happening because of you.
Absolutely.
And I think the same principle applies here.
Oh, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. And it is gratifying, I think, to see, you know, so many people, I think, on social media start to kind of start making these connections where, you know, this whole idea of just hand waving people away as quote unquote lone wolves, I think, has finally gotten through from like our side of the house, Spike, where, like, you know, between you guys, like us incredible scholars like Kathleen Ballou and Cynthia Miller Idris, who've been like stressing for years, like, no guys, this is a strategy, this is specifically designed to insulate key members of the movement. I think that it is very gratifying to see that I think has finally broken through or broken out of academic circles, because we've been tearing our hair out over this for so long.
Yes, exactly. And the idea of leaderless resistance as kind of a form, or perhaps even evolving into a form of stochastic terrorism that we see within kind of like these far-right rhetorics, right? Because there is a line, there is a rhetoric that's being pushed by all of these kind of various different far-right pundits, but even like politicians these days, right? So I'm specifically thinking back to the guy in Pennsylvania who literally beheaded his father.
Right.
Because he had been fed rhetoric about the invasion that was going on south of the border, right? And how Joe Biden is destroying America by allowing all these immigrants in. And he specifically called on conservatives to overthrow the government, right? He was very specific in saying and kind of hearkening to a call to kind of action, but he got all of his rhetorical points from congressmen, right? From like elected representatives of the United States who were pushing anti-immigration rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the knee-jerk reaction from all of those politicians were to say, he didn't get that from us. He's a crazy QAnon guy, right? Which, right. Again, that's a very useful rhetorical tool for politicians and more public figures, is to have this kind of more fringe, radical, extreme, conspiratorial bucket that they can drop inconvenient actors into, right? Because if people made the point and made the assertion, which is the correct assertion, that the rhetoric he was using, like, yeah, tangentially kind of related to QAnon, but not really. Like, it's much more pulled and derived from what actual far-right politicians were saying, then that's problematic, right? Because, oh, the people who support these politicians are people who chop the heads off of their family members, right? Because they work for the federal government. And so this whole idea of using the rhetoric to create this idea of either lone wolves or having a rhetorical bucket people can be thrown into, like QAnon, that just allows these politicians to sweep things under the rug. It's very kind of nice to see that people aren't buying into those kind of myths anymore. Like at such a large scale level, at least. I very much think people still do buy into it to a certain extent, but there's more questions.
Right. And it starts with opening up that window. It starts with opening up that sense of, this is a vulnerability that these people have because of where they are. They can then gradually be kind of moved a little farther and a little farther down this. But it starts with things like what we're seeing right now, these videos, these Reddit posts, these Twitch streamers. This is what we're looking at in terms of the genesis moment for where this is all going.
Yeah, and I know like Mike and I have been DMing with each other for the past couple of days, and yeah, we are worried. Like we are legitimately concerned about where this could go. Obviously, we're hoping that, you know, this dies on the vine, as previous attempts by, you know, the Gamergate folks have over the past 10 years to, again, kind of restart that engine. But the risks are there. And again, on from multiple perspectives, both in terms of, again, another mass radicalization event that may usher in more far-right politicians into office, or the eventual motivation of one or potentially more than one active lone actor terrorism. Yeah, the risks here are very serious.
Right, right. And this is just something we're going to have to continue to keep an eye on, continue to look out for, monitor, yeah, and call out when we see it. Like I said, we're at the very beginning of this. If this goes any farther, this is something that's been going on for maybe a couple weeks now, and it's just starting to bubble up.
Yeah, and I think as you guys rightly point out, people are, I think, you know, waking up to the effects of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
Libs of TikTok being one of the best examples, but, you know, recognition is one thing. The tools we have for meaningfully addressing it are still so woefully limited, in that, you know, there's a reason this has been such a popular tactic for so long, right? In that the degree of deniability it sets up makes actual targeted, you know, interdiction of this stuff difficult, if not impossible.
Right.
Right. In that, you know, fundamentally, the only thing we can really stipulate is what, you know, like deplatforming, right? That's kind of the only coherent strategy that has emerged when it comes to meaningfully addressing these folks, is deplatforming. And I do think we've seen some evidence that deplatforming can be effective. Like, I'd argue that, you know, the fact that YouTube and most of the other major social media folks, you know, kicked off, you know, the Nick Fuenteses and the big QAnon folks, I would argue that that very likely had a positive effect.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, as you both and so many of your guests know, Griff, there are so many ways for those people to circumvent that.
Sure, sure.
There's a million different ways for, you know, someone like Fuentes, who has been comprehensively deplatformed, probably more so than any far right actor right now. And he's still all over the place.
Right. But he's less all over the place when he doesn't have a Twitter account.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I think people have to remember. Like, if this wasn't a big deal, if this wasn't something that he was really, really like needing to spread his message, as it were, he would not throw such a baby fit every time Twitter gets him. And he does. You can look at his Telegram channel every time he's gotten banned, and he throws a fit. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
And along those lines, I don't necessarily know how to feel when it comes to more mainstream media outlets covering this. Because I know, Mike, you and I were talking about how this story is, you know, kind of starting to break containment a little bit with more mainstream publications like Kotaku, PC Gamer, and various other journalistic outlets starting to report on this. And I'm of two minds, right, in that being aware of these developing events seems good. We want people to be aware, but, you know, knowing that so much of these movements comes down to how much oxygen they receive, how much of a footing they're able to establish outside of their immediate niches.
Yeah, it's a tough balance to strike.
And kind of what you were going on to there, Andy, it just gives them more ammo, right? You go onto some of these subreddits and it's like, look what PC Gamer's having now. Look at the depth that this conspiracy has gone to. Like, they've infected PC Gamer. And then if more and more mainstream outlets start covering this, that just gives them more incentive to keep doing this, right? Because, I mean, part of the trolling mentality, right, if we go back to some of the academic literature on this, part of it is about getting that coverage. Because every time you get that coverage, be it positive or negative, you're getting mentioned. So, and that's kind of a win. Yeah. Right. So again, that's why I'm also of two minds about this of like, yeah, I would like quote unquote normies to know what's going on, but that just means this is another post on the subreddit about how there's media being mentioned here.
Well, and I think what you have to do, and I've thought about this a lot, if you're going to cover this for a normie audience, you have to figure out what kind of coverage the folks that are spreading this won't like. You have to absolutely figure out what kind of coverage can you put out there that is going to completely backfire on them if they try to push it to their audience. And I think what that comes down to is putting people like you guys who are actual experts in this stuff, both from a academic perspective and from a, hey, we're both native to this culture. We know what you're doing type of scene. No, I'm serious. Because you can turn that back at them and say, you may be able to run this language past reporters who don't understand what you're doing here, but we do. And that's the kind of thing that, with any luck, they're not going to want to share with their audience because it makes them look terrible. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one place where a lot of mainstream reporting on this stuff falls down.
Yeah.
Is because they don't understand that piece of it. They don't understand that for a lot of these people, any publicity is good publicity. Well, not necessarily, but you got to be pretty thought out about how you do it. And there are people out here who can do it. So I would say reach out if you're one of those people.
Yeah.
And get somebody on who understands this stuff and understands this stuff in a way that they're not going to get quote tweeted as, oh, look at the lying media. They don't understand anything we're doing. Yeah, we actually do.
As I'm sure you can tell, Mike and I do love to talk. and Riv, though, I think you make a really interesting point there, you know, and I think the other element that I think a lot of the reporting falls into, or kind of the trap that they end up walking into, is that they assume that everyone involved in these spaces is trying to kind of persuade as many people possible, mm-hmm. right? Trying to win the debate of ideas.
Right.
And I think back to a discussion I was having with Shannon Martinez.
Okay.
I know, Mike, I think you know Shannon, works a lot on disengagement, specifically trying to like help people disengage from far right and white power outlets. She was actually giving a talk on a Zoom call in front of my class, actually. So shout out to Shan. She hit on this, and I always remember this, in that when a far right or white power actor is in front of a crowd, they're not trying to convince as many people as possible, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to convince one person. If they come away from a talk where 99% of that crowd hates their guts, but one person who wasn't necessarily giving them the time of day prior is now, maybe I need to go look into this more.
Yeah.
From their perspective, that's a win.
Yeah.
That's a win. And that very much kind of colors my interpretation of, you know, this debate of how do we cover this stuff? How do you present it in a way that is accurate, that is responsible, and doesn't inadvertently get that information to that one person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you mentioned something about manifestos and their crappy copy-pasted manifestos, and a lot of the time, that's a tactic. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen it done a few times where they've spelled Kaczynski wrong. Why? Because they want you to go Google that.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to go look that guy up, or, you know, ha-ha, look at him, we're going to dunk on him, he can't even spell, you know, the Unabomber's name right. Well.
Yep. This is why Mike, I, and like every other extremism researcher on Twitter in the wake of any kind of shooting or terrorist attack is all caps tweeting, do not post manifestos.
Yeah, no, never.
Yep. Don't do it.
If you take one thing away from this podcast, you don't need to share that. They want you to share it. They did the whole thing, so you'd share it.
They want you to do it. They're designed to be read. They cannot be taken at face value. For the love of God, do not share them. Please.
Stop doing it. You don't need to share the videos. You don't need to share the manifestos. You don't need to do that. It's what they want. If you want this to stop happening on some level, that's where it starts. Stop making that tactic actually work for them.
Please. Please, oh, please, oh,
yes,
please.
Yes, I agree 100, 110% about that.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you very much for coming on today. This has been a very enlightening discussion. I'm glad that we were able to get some thoughts out on this, because I don't think this is the last we're going to hear of this, but at least we are watching what's going on here. And if, God forbid, this continues, we can, you know, pick it up from there and not have to start back at the beginning. And we're not going to get surprised by this one again. They're not going to be able to do that, unfortunately. But here we are.
Yeah, my pleasure. Again, thanks so much for having me. I think I speak for Mike as well when I say we hope we're wrong, and we hope this dies on the vine.
Exactly. Yes. Please die on the vine. We hope so.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, thanks for having me again as well, Griff. Always happy to be here. If you need me to ever stand on my soapbox and yell about Gamergate and how we don't cover it enough and how people don't get it, I'm always more than happy to contribute.
You know, and it's the kind of thing I hope I don't have to call you for, but it's the kind of thing that keeps coming up. So, I mean, what do you do, right?
Well, what do you do indeed? It's one of those things where it's like, I wish I didn't have job security, right? I wish my research field was irrelevant, but here we are.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that. Like, just last night, as I'm talking about, you know, prepping for this, my wife says to me, "Man, I wish this stuff would just go away." Well, I don't know what that would mean for your job security, though. I'd be like, I'd figure out something else to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh yeah, we could talk about something else. I mean, there's plenty of other things I'm interested in. Just
I can go talk about baseball. I can go talk about soccer. I can go talk about actually liking video games. You know, I could talk about Helldivers 2 all day. But
right. All right. Well, thank you for your time, guys. You have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find us on the web at didnothingwrongpod.com. Please make sure you subscribe to get our content straight into your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at GrizzaBJJ, GrzaBJJ, as well as DNWPod. We're extremely grateful for paid subscriptions and donations that allow us to keep doing this important work. Thanks, and remember, everyone mentioned did nothing wrong.